And welcome to the February 13th, 2019 afternoon oral argument call for the Court of Appeals. We have done a little bit of rearranging, so we'll be starting with State versus Carminati's and putting Pittack versus Pittack to the end of our list today. And just as a reminder, we are live streaming on NET TV, so if there's anything sensitive in your arguments to us today, please be mindful that it is being live streamed. So with that, State versus Carminati's, helpful.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. Hey, Kelly. I'd ask to reserve 1 minute for rebuttal, please. My name is Christopher Eichel. I represent the appellant on direct appeal. This is a direct appeal from a conviction for two felony charges, theft by deception and another felony charge of criminal possession of four or more financial transaction devices. In my brief, I allege a number of different assignment of errors. I'm not going to argue those today. Unless I'm asked about those, I'll respond to them, of course. But I'm going to argue a couple of points with respect to the ineffective assistance of counsel claims that we do raise in our brief. This is a direct appeal, and the appellant is represented by different counsel than trial counsel. And as this court is aware, when a defendant appellant is represented on direct appeal by counsel different than that appellant must allege any issue of trial counsel performance alleged to be ineffective. The court is, of course, aware of what the standard is to prevail on a claim of ineffective assistance of counsel. The appellant must show that counsel was deficient and that this deficient performance actually caused prejudice to the defendant's case. One argument I want to make with respect to trial counsel's deficient performance is trial counsel's failure to object to the state requesting leave to add an additional charge just days before jury trial. This trial counsel's actions, there's no discernible, in my opinion, and I'd argue from the record, there's no discernible trial strategy from trial counsel's decision to not object and to waive all the different rights that go along with an amendment to an information. It can only be described as deficient performance. The issue, is it prejudice to defendant, the appellant? We'd argue that it is, because not only was the defendant then exposed to further criminal exposure with another felony charge, which is double the felony charge he's looking at to begin with, it affected the scope of evidence that was allowed to be adduced against him with respect to the first count, and of course the court, when he was found guilty, imposed a consecutive sentence and gave him 2 to 4 more additional years.
But how is the evidence any different with regard to the devices than it would have been with regard to the theft?
I suppose the number of devices perhaps that he was found with ultimately or at least have control of, that would have been less relevant as to the count one, because I think there were just, if I remember right, 3 or 4 victims that they alleged that this appellant used the transactional or financial transaction device information to buy things at Sam's Club. The other evidence, I think, well, it's clear. Now, the appellee argues that it's not deficient performance because even had trial counsel objected, the state would have been given leave to amend the information. I don't think that can be concluded whatsoever. The request to amend the information was made on November 28, 2017. Trial started December 4th and went for 4 days. And I think somewhere in the record, December 4th is a Monday, so we're talking the Tuesday before November 28th, the state makes an oral motion to amend. The trial counsel waived, first didn't object to the request to amend. The trial counsel then waived the right to have a preliminary hearing in this case under 29-1607. Trial counsel also waived the right to be served with the amended information and then by the sheriff and then wait 24 hours. The trial court indicated, and I point out in the brief, that the trial court was concerned about the logistical difficulties of trying this defendant, which on November 16, 2017, had been joined with the co-defendant's case, where both defendants needed interpreters. The trial schedule is already tight, and I would argue that if you look at the logistical difficulties of accommodating all the rights that trial counsel waived, the way I'm trying to say this is the probability of the court allowing the state to amend that in that later game wouldn't be.
But, I mean, the state could have brought those charges separately.
Absolutely.
Right.
They could have done so. Absolutely.
And so, again, I'm trying to understand what the prejudice was. I mean, I think the Supreme Court has allowed for amendment within days of trial, right, as long as there's no prejudice to the defendant in doing that. So that's what I'm trying to understand here is how are the facts different in the financial devices versus the theft by deception?
Well, the facts weren't different, perhaps, but that's not the only way that the defendant was prejudiced. Obviously, he's prejudiced because you give him more prison time. The state is piling on a charge. One could infer
but he could have been separately convicted anyway and got that prison time through a separate conviction or separate trial and conviction.
Maybe, if double jeopardy does not attach. The fact that the state could have brought the two charges is, in some respects, an argument against the state being given leave to amend so late in the game. They had a pretrial hearing, a pretrial conference on November 16th when the cases were joined. No mention of the amended or requested amendment information was made there. The fact that the state could have brought it originally with two charges goes both ways. In some respects, why is the state doing it now? But more importantly, if you focus on trial counsel's deficient performance, the only way the state gets from point A to point B in those 3 or 4 days is if trial counsel helps the state. And that's all that can be concluded what he did. He waived the right to have a preliminary hearing. He waived service. And I'd argue with the logistical difficulties of having a consolidated case, interpreters, arranging interpreters, a separate judge to do the preliminary hearing, those things arguably could not be accommodated. The court didn't even exercise any discretion in this case. It was a stipulation by the parties to add this additional charge, essentially.
Were there already a couple of interpreters lined up for the trial with regard to the theft by deception?
For the trial.
Yeah. And did they have to add any more because of the additional charges?
I don't believe for the trial itself, but I think under 29-1607, a person has a right to have a preliminary hearing on a separate charge, a felony charge, for a different judge. There would have to be, presumably, an interpreter there for that. And who knows who that judge would be and what that calendar is for that court in those 3 or 4 days before trial starting on December 4th.
Did he have a preliminary hearing on the first one?
I didn't represent him at trial, so I can't recall. I seem to think that perhaps he did, but I'm not certain of that. And that may not be actually in the record anyway, other than unless it's in the transcript that was included in the county court to the district court. I can't recall.
Okay, we had to.
The other argument I want to make with respect to trial counsel's performance and ineffective assistance of counsel is trial counsel's failure, and this is like a two-part argument, to object, to move to sequester witnesses for the trial and to essentially allow Investigator Fossler, the state's expert, if you will, witness, and principal witness in this case to remain in the courtroom. The second part of that argument, as I allege in the brief, is the improper, we would argue, improper opinion testimony that Investigator Fossler gave as to Mr. Carmenetti's, this appellant's guilt and the co-defendant's guilt as well in committing the crimes in this case. The state, or the appellee, responds that even though the trial counsel did not move to sequester witnesses under 27615, under 27615, a representative of the state may be permitted to be in the courtroom and hear all the other witness testimony. I would argue that the appellee's characterization of law is not that clear. I know the statute does allow for seemingly exempts a non-person party to have a representative there on their behalf, but if you look at the annotated cases, particularly the case that I discussed, State versus Freeman, in that case, State versus Freeman, the state gave notice to the defendant that they were going to have a police officer be there in court, special representative or whatever they designated it at. The defendant and Freeman objected. The trial court had a hearing and made a decision. That would imply that it is a matter of court's discretion to permit someone here. And in this case, Investigator Fossler was allowed to remain in the courtroom, hear all the evidence, not clear from the record, but presumably sit at counsel table. And then when he testified as to his opinion of what various exhibits depicted. And I know that the appellee responds that Investigator Fossler did not give his opinion as to the defendant's guilt. But I think arguably if you consider what Investigator Fossler opined, he is. He's asked to give an opinion as to who is conducting these transactions. Based on his experience, based on his evidence, based on his observation, who is committing or who's conducting these transactions? That's the commission of the crime. That is opinion testimony. It's not simply a witness helping a fact finder identify what's on an exhibit. In other words, the Investigator Foster is not asked to describe how tall does that person seem to be? What is that person wearing? Does that person look similar to anybody here? It's simply, what is your opinion as to what that means? And I think with the fact with Investigator Foster remaining there sort of as an, I guess a representative, sort of as a super witness, if you will, giving his opinion based on the evidence as to who is has committed these crimes and therefore who is guilty is improper. That is exactly what this court and the Supreme Court is cautioning against, the government giving opinion testimony.
Even if we were to find that counsel was deficient in not making those objections, wouldn't the effect be not prejudicial in light of Rodriguez's testimony that very directly identifies this defendant as the perpetrator?
Well, I suppose the court would have to do a harmless error analysis. We would argue that the state law enforcement officer giving his opinion as to something like this is simply just so prejudicial that it can't be overcome and it can't be separated on a harmless error.
But it was really about identifying, you know, who's seen in those videos, and the jury was there to be able to see Mr. Carminati's themselves directly as well and make that correlation, couldn't they?
That's true. That's correct.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. May it please the court, I'm Kimberly Klein, Assistant Attorney General representing the state in this matter. And as I'd like to take up the issue of Investigator Fossler first, since it sort of overlaps a couple of his assignments of error. First, with respect to the motion to sequester the witnesses, no, the state could have made a motion to have Investigator Fossler remain as its, basically designated representative. And that, by statute, is about as pro forma a motion as is allowed in the law. Essentially, if the state asks that an officer or whoever be their designated representative, the court is pretty much obliged to grant it. The statute 615 says that the rule does not authorize exclusion of a party who is a natural person or an officer or employee of a party which is not a natural person designated as its representative by its attorney. I don't think I've ever seen a district court deny the state's motion to have an officer remain as its designated representative. Had the court, even if he had asked the witnesses be sequestered, the state could have and undoubtedly would have asked that Fossler remain as their designated employee in the state, the court would have been basically obliged to grant that. With respect to his Fossler's testimony about the videos, there's only one instance in which Fossler is actually asked about Carminati's. The rest of the questions that he was asked were with respect to the co-defendant Lopez. Fossler was asked if, on one occasion, if he thought Lopez was responsible for the transactions depicted in a particular video. He said, yeah, I think it is him. And he was also asked if he thought Carminati's was responsible. And he says, yeah, I think that is him that's in the video there. And I think you need to draw a distinction between Fossler saying, yes, I think he is guilty of the crimes, and what he was actually asked, which was, do you think that that's Carminati's that's being shown on that video there? And that's really what he was being asked, albeit in kind of a not very adept way.
But he was being asked specific to certain exhibits that tied the transaction to the bank records and to the receipts, and so he was being asked to form an opinion with regard to whether that was Carminati's engaging in that particular transaction. So isn't that asking for an opinion as to guilt?
I think the way it was asked was, do you think that Carminati's is responsible for that transaction? And they were basically pointing at the video at the time. The jury still has, even if they thought, yeah, that's Carminati's in that video, they still have to go through the rest of the steps to determine whether or not he was using the financial transaction devices or whether or not he was committing theft by deception.
And isn't that for them to decide? I mean, the investigator could present all the evidence and show the links between the evidence, but ultimately to identify Carminati's, wasn't that something the jury should have decided?
Well, it is for the jury, but I don't think it's necessarily error for the officer to give essentially an opinion as to ultimate guilt. I think if you go back through the cases of Rocha from 2017 from the Supreme Court being the most recent, it's not necessarily error for them to say, yeah, I think that that is the party responsible. And as you, I think, taken in context of the questioning at the time, what Fosler was being asked is, do you think that's Carminati's in the videos? Because the videos, you know, they're not the best quality. They're kind of grainy. The faces aren't real clear in a lot of them.
Speaking of the videos, were you able to watch all of them?
No.
Okay.
It wasn't just me then.
There's some technology issues with the videos that were offered. Unfortunately, the court's able to access some older equipment, or I don't know, but a lot of different types of equipment had to be tested. And I know that you didn't present this evidence, but to the extent, you know, I think prosecutors, whoever is presenting this kind of DVD evidence, we need to be sure that the court is able to review those DVDs.
Yeah, that would come in real handy, wouldn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah.
But yeah, no, I wasn't able to watch all of them either, and okay, good. I'm actually kind of glad to hear you say that.
Well, it's a problem, I think, that needs to be communicated.
Yeah, I agree. And with respect to the amendment of to the information, it was a relatively late amendment, but with respect to ineffectiveness and whether or not he was prejudiced, I don't think there's any prejudice because the amended information doesn't list any additional witnesses. There isn't, as far as I can tell, there was no additional discovery that needed to be provided. Everything had been provided to him already, the witness list, all the, you know, the documentation and all that had already been provided.
It does subject him to a longer sentence, though.
Right? It does. It does.
But is that not prejudicial?
Well, as Judge Bishop pointed out, he could have been charged separately. And with that, and have been, you know, gone through a separate trial on that. But
is that something we can decide? I mean, just because he could have, can we assume that the state would have?
Well, I think so, because if they went and amended the information to charge him with both of those, there would be no reason not to. If that had been denied, there would have been no reason not to go through and just simply file new charges charging the financial transaction devices. Yeah, there.
But
it would have been
a
simple matter.
But for the time and expenses of an additional trial and the interpreters and all of that.
It would be an additional expense, but that's just the nature of the beast, I guess. And because it is more, I guess, efficient to go ahead and include them as a single trial and a single, if you will, transaction in court, there wasn't any reason not to go ahead and do that. Like I said, there was no additional discovery, apparently, that was provided, no additional witnesses. It was just essentially the evidence was all going to be the same regardless of what the charges were. And it was, you know, it was there or it wasn't there. And so I don't think that, based on this record right now, we can conclude that he was prejudiced. If you aren't comfortable concluding that, then we would say that the claim has been preserved for post-conviction. Your Honors, there were a number of other issues. We think those have been addressed in our briefs, unless, of course, you have additional questions on some of the others.
Yeah, I wouldn't mind going back to Investigator Foster's testimony for a moment. If we were to conclude that counsel wasn't effective for not making objections to some of that testimony, I assume it's your position that no prejudice could be established, regardless because of the other evidence that came in, like from Rodriguez, who pointed the finger at him.
Right.
As kind of being a co-conspirator, really, in this
yeah,
whole thing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I think if you do come to the conclusion that it was ineffective or at least unexplained, I think at best, I'm always hesitant to conclude ineffectiveness on direct appeal because we don't know what the reasons were, and none of us at this point are privy to what the discussions were between counsel and his client. And
you mean for not objecting?
Yeah.
I mean, in terms of not objecting when maybe there should have been objections, we can probably decide that on the record.
Yeah, we could decide that, you know, an objection would have been warranted, but, you know, again, who knows why he did or didn't. You know, there may have been, he may have had some weird strategy that, you know, just because it doesn't play out doesn't mean it isn't reasonable. And so I'm always a little hesitant about finding counsel ineffective on direct appeal without knowing what they were thinking at the time. At best, I think it's non-prejudicial, and I think at worst it's been preserved for post-conviction. Unless there are other questions, then we would ask that the judgment and sentences be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And I don't believe we have any time for rebuttal. All right. Well, thank you both very much. The matter is submitted. You're excused.